the story of Yavesh Gilad is one of those stories that we're never done with because it'll stay with us the rest of Tanakh. So it's kind of like one of those moments in history that has ramifications for generations to come. And part of that we're going to see today, and part of that we'll see when we... But we are a couple of weeks till the end of Shoftim. And I don't know, you want to have a Siyum or something. I don't know. It's been 4 years that we've been plowing through Shoftim, so it's quite good. Okay, let me give you...
You know, like you announce for all the men who
have... Well, we should have a Siyum. Something. We should celebrate, you know, accomplishment of sorts.
Mm-hmm. Alan has a sly smile on his face.
We've accomplished, you know, 4 years of
comments.
How about a big sigh and move on?
Why, beginning the rest of Tanakh is any happy go luckier? All right. Let's just take one and let me split this. Take one and pass them down. And the extras pass back up here. All right. So. What was the last thing we... Anyone remember what we did last week? I won't ask you what we did last year. But last week, what was the last thing we did? You have good nights.
We were talking... Wait a minute.
Pinchas.
Right. So we Pinchas. Reached the point in our discussion where we had come to the conclusion that the Pinchas actually not only was he faulted with the failure of the Urim V'Tumim when they went to war with Binyamin, but in our assertion that in fact Yavesh Gilad had not, that the story of Yavesh Gilad and the attack on Yavesh Gilad was actually an earlier story. There you go. I'll have to ask the question about next week again. That the attack on Yavesh Gilad had actually been an earlier story, and that was a prelude to the war with Binyamin. That's the big chiddush. That the war with Yavesh Gilad had in fact been a prelude to the war with Binyamin, a step one, a distraction, if you will, a sidebar. And ultimately the reason for the guilt of the Israel that led to the failure in the war with Binyamin. It's, had they gone to war with Binyamin originally, you could argue that they would have been justified. By virtue of the fact that they go to this side war against the innocent Yavesh Gilad, who had nothing to do with anything, and then come back to Binyamin, although it's not written that way, but if that's in fact the way we understand the story, then we understand how the Urim V'Tumim essentially sends them into battle to fail, twice, in order to sort of avenge the blood of Yavesh Gilad. And what we had concluded was that the first two campaigns against Binyamin, Israel, Binyamin wins in order to avenge the blood of Yavesh Gilad, and the third day, Israel wins in order to avenge the blood of the Pilegesh and the story as it had begun. We left a couple of questions, somewhat answered and somewhat unanswered, when we started to talk about the nature of the war with Yavesh Gilad and how the dynamic of how that battle unfolded, we discovered the fingerprint of Pinchas. Right? The comparison to the story of Pinchas in the Torah and the war against Midian, the formula for that war, which ultimately was the formula employed against the war of Yavesh Gilad, a formula which has no other context other than the war with Midian, and really gives us a kind of a fingerprint of Pinchas' handiwork. And that, to an extent, raised the question of whether or not the failure of Pinchas was not so much the misreading of the Urim V'Tumim, perhaps the first two times to go to war, but a much broader failure, where he is essentially the one responsible for the war with Yavesh Gilad. In fact, he perhaps even leads the war against Yavesh Gilad. It has all the formula and all the tell signs of the war with Benot Midian that Pinchas did lead a generation earlier. And that raised And in that context, we also discuss the fact that the Urim V'Tumim is nowhere to be found. So Pinchas, the Kohen Gadol, is perfectly willing to ask the Urim V'Tumim whether or not to go to war against the very fortified and strong people of Binyamin, but against the innocent and blameless people and defenseless people of Yavesh Gilad. Suddenly Pinchas gets all righteous on them and doesn't, leading a righteous battle, doesn't even bother with Urim V'Tumim. And at that point, we can understand the failure of the Urim V'Tumim to lead them correctly, or it did lead them correctly, but the failure from their perspective could also be attributed to the arrogance of Pinchas to suggest that when it comes to this war, I know better, I can go there without the Urim V'Tumim, the war with Binyamin being a different story. What we haven't addressed is why. What's driving Pinchas' motivation to this war with Yavesh Gilad? It's one thing to say they took an oath that anybody didn't come to heed the call of the king or the call of Israel should be put to death. It's another to lead a battle against these people. Formula of Midian, really with all of the anger and with all of the zealotry that Pinchas is capable of, to lead a war against the people of Yavesh Gilad. What did Yavesh Gilad ever do to Pinchas to drive that kind of energy and zealotry? And that's a critical question. Because the question of Yavesh Gilad, and I want to repeat something I just said a few minutes ago, but I'm not sure we really focused on it. This isn't just one incident in Tanakh. One of the reasons why Pelegesh Begiva and particularly the role of Yavesh Gilad is so central, and we spent so much time on it, coming back to your question earlier, is the fact that the story of Yavesh Gilad will stay with us for the rest of Tanakh. It kind of hovers over Tanakh like a shadow, that one way or another, l'tov or l'ra, in some context, that you can't escape the story of Yavesh Gilad. And I'll show you one example of that today, hopefully, and then we'll see other examples of it in a couple of weeks. But it's really it's a critical piece, and it's a critical piece to understand. So let's start from the first question. What's motivating Binyamin? Reframe that. What's motivating Yavesh Gilad? Why didn't Yavesh Gilad come to the call when every other tribe in Israel showed up, when every other tribe in Israel came hot under the collar? What's so special about Yavesh Gilad?
I gave us
the answer already, so now we're going to see the answer, because this will sort of segue into our next issue. All right? That, if you take a look at the source pages that I just gave you.
Wasn't there a connection later with Shaul?
Oh, that, what I was alluding to when I said that this story is going to hover over Tanakh like a shadow, that's the story we're going to come back to. I'm not sure we'll get to it today, but we'll certainly try to get to it soon. That's the first time we see this story reasserting itself, but we're going to see other examples of it also. But if you take a look in source number one, just a little bit of a reminder of our geography. The war with Binyamin is here in the area. Binyamin sits between Yehudah and Ephraim. Many, many years later, when the kingdom splits, it will split over the fault line between Binyamin and Ephraim right at Beit El. Beit El will become the border between the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom. But that's an unnatural border, because Binyamin really belongs to the daughters, to the sons of Rachel, and therefore Binyamin, Ephraim, and Menashe are really one unit. So the natural grouping would be Binyamin, Ephraim, and Menashe. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
Why the fault line of the split of the kingdom happens here, why Binyamin stays with Yehuda, is a whole different issue that we'll address in Sefer Shmuel. But it's important to make that observation now. So we are now sitting in this area of Binyamin, Mitzpeh, Giv'ah, here. The capital of the tribe of Benjamin is a city called... Do you know what the capital was?
Of Benjamin?
Of... I believe so. It's the city of Ramah. Where's the Ramah and Ephraim? Ramah Benjamin and Ephraim. Okay, I take that back. But Givah is here in this area. Ephraim is to the north of it. Remember we talked about the trip from Mitzpeh to Shiloh? And Yavesh Gilad, the Gilad is up here. The Gilad is up here. Gilad is part of Shevet Menashe. Gilad is a sub-tribe of Menashe. And Yavesh Gilad, I'm not sure it's on this map even. It is, I don't have it here. It is on one of the maps that I gave you earlier with this, with the... I didn't bring all those maps. I think I did. At some point or another, I left some... I had given out a map that looked like... It looked like this. It had Pilegish Begiv on one side and Yavesh Gilad on the other side. I don't know if you have it with you or not. I have a couple of copies of it here. Just happened by accident. If you want to send that down and share.
Sit down.
All right. So if you look on this map from Yericho, you see where it says Givon just beneath the words Binyamin? That's essentially the area that we're talking about. Yericho to the right, Giv'ah, Mitzpeh just north of it, Shiloh north of that, and if you go from Shiloh, cross over the Yarden, and go halfway up to the Kinneret, about here where it says the word Gilad, here's Ramot Gilad, and I assume Yavesh Gilad is somewhere.
It's right there.
It's on this valley. It's, right, it's across from Emek Beit Shan.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. So if you look at this map and you consider the fact that they're sitting here, the Mitzpeh Benjamin is just here north of Givad. This is where the battle is taking place. They can march to Shiloh and back because they're north of Givah, or just the northeast. To march all the way up to Yavesh Gilad in order to come back to this battle with Benjamin. Right, so agreed they only send 12,000 soldiers. But it's quite a distraction from their focus, which is, of course, the city of Giv'ah.
And it's their best soldiers, most likely.
And it probably is their best soldiers. It probably is their best soldiers. And it's certainly led by the Kohen Gadol, Pinchas, and all of that complexity that we spoke about. So, ultimately, the question is, what's burning in Yavesh Gilad that why they sat out this campaign in the first place, and why Pinchas turns his wrath, dafka, on this poor, innocent city, rather than on the perpetrators of this crime in Shevet Benjamin, or at least the city of Giv'ah. So, when we look at source number one, which is Pasuk and Sefer Ovadia. How we get to Ovadia, whole different issue, but just pluck a Pasuk out of Sefer Ovadia, and you'll see something interesting. V'yoshua negev et har Esav. Some vision of the Navi, Ovadia, of the future, just many, many years later. Many years later. But he's talking about some vision of the future, where the Negev, the Jews, the tribes who live in the south, and he identifies tribes in this pasuk by their geographic region. So the tribes of the Negev will inherit, will possess the land of Har Esav, as we say in the pasuk, right? There's a notion that eventually Ovadia's entire book, which is one chapter long, his entire book is a nevuah against Edom. So he's addressing the conquest, the eventual vision that despite all that Edom is doing to us now in the time of Avadia, there will come a time when that table will be turned. So V'yoshua negev et har Esav. V'hashvela et haplishtim. So again, if you're looking at the map, the south, the Negev, the tribes that live in the south, will expand southward to possess the land of Edom and Har Esav. The tribes of the Shvela, the plains, will expand westward to inherit, to possess the land that is today, meaning in the time of Avadia, the land of Plishtim. V'yorshu et Sde Ephraim, and they shall possess the fields of Ephraim, ve'et Sde Shomron, and the fields of the Shomron. In other words, they'll reclaim the lands of Ephraim and the Shomron. Uvinyamin et Hagilad. And Binyamin will once again take possession of the Gilad. Now, what's immediately striking about this pasuk?
That word Binyamin.
How did Binyamin end up in Gilad? Gilad is Shevet Menashe. Gilad is Shevet Menashe. I mean, Gilad is the grandson of Menashe. If you take a look down in source number 5, I'll skip for a moment, just the first pasuk of source number 5, Divrei Hayamim Perek Aleph, Divrei Hayamim Aleph Perek Zayin, Bnei Menashe, the children of Menashe, Asriel, Ashieldad Pilaksha Amiyah, Yaldat Machir Avi Gilad. Bnei Menashe bore, amongst the children of Menashe, are Machir. Machir is mentioned in Sefer Breshit. So is Gilad, father of Gilad. Come with the rest of this pasuk, I'll deal with in a moment. So how does Gilad, grandson of Menashe, end up being referenced in Sefer Ovadia as a land that will eventually be claimed by Binyamin? And that's the question that the Mefarshim ask. So before we get to our discussion about Yavesh Gilad, that's the question the Mefarshim ask. Go back up to sources 2, 3, and 4. Rashi, Binyamin et Gilad. So Rashi suggests Ubnei Menashe, Shaita Eretz Gilad Shalahem, Yifshitu Lehem Mehala Likvulatela Shal Eretz Yisrael B'Mizracha. Which is going to be a shift, says Rashi. Bnei Menashe will shift eastward, further out, and so Bnei Binyamin will shift further eastward also into the tribal territory of the Gilad. So that in this vision of the future, all the tribe, the expansion of the boundaries of the land of Israel and the tribes and their location. So if I move Binyamin into the Gilad, it means that I'm moving Menashe further east as well in order to claim the land.
Is this future?
This is Avadia talking about the future. Correct. This is Avadia talking.
And how much future are we talking about?
Traditionally, we attribute it to Yemot HaMashiach, but that's a separate discussion. But certainly, Avadia is. Avadia is big discussion about when Avadia lived, which I don't want to get into too much. But certainly, 500 years later than our story right now, at least, if not more. And he's talking about
future.
Similarly, the Radak in source 4. Chem Binyamin sheyakvulo biyarden yirsha misham vahala et hamishor be'eretz Gilad. Similarly, Binyamin, whose boundary was on the west of the Yarden, will expand into the plains on the other side, into the land of Gilad, shume'ever liyarden, ki arbe gvulo. God will expound their boundaries. Kol mishor Gilad shu samuch l'nachalato. Ki Menashe shehaya lo eretz Gilad yitpashet gvulo misham v'hala be'eretz Moav u'bnei Amon. Binyamin will move eastward, because Menasheh too will move eastward. What the Mefarshim don't address, and I think is the critical question, is of all the places, why put Binyamin in the Gilad? I showed you the geography. Here's Binyamin. Here's Ephraim. Here's Gilad. You want to push Menasheh east and expand the boundaries of the tribes west into the east. So expand Menasheh eastward across this direction. And then Menasheh west. There's a whole half of tribe of Menasheh over here that can move eastward. Or at best, maybe Ephraim, Har Ephraim goes all the way up to Shechem. Maybe Ephraim can move eastward. But of all the tribes of Israel, to take Binyamin all the way down here, south of Beit El, and expound his boundaries eastward, not into the area of Gad, but into the area of Gilad, that's not eastward. That's northeast, more north than east.
And Shevet Dan needed more space, so they could all... Right.
They went all the way... Well, that Moshe had assigned to them already way back when. So the notion that somehow Binyamin ends up in some sort of future vision settling in the area of the Gilad raises the question. What's the connection between... Or strengthens the question. What's the connection between Binyamin and Gilad? If I understand that connection, it may also help us understand the motivation of Yavesh Gilad not to participate in this campaign. So if you take a look at sources 5 and 6, sources 5 and 6 are a series of psukim from Tanakh, the parts of Tanakh that even when we study them typically, we tend to gloss over them, because when we start getting into lists of lineage, our minds tend to wander, mine included, and I do not profess to be any kind of expert in the lineage of Tanakh, but when you look at the Mefarshim, they draw the connections for us. So here's a pasuk, and it's a very strange pasuk. I read the first part earlier, source number 5. I have these children of Menasheh, Machir Avi Gilad, Machir ben Menasheh, father of Gilad. Pasuk Tzedvav, Machir Lakach. Forget that you're going to have to leave the translation for a moment, because it's going to confuse us. Machir Lakach Isha Lechupim Ulishupim. Machir took a wife Lechupim Ulishupim. What does that mean?
I guess there was children.
Are they his children? Are they his sons? Are they the names of his wives? Lakach isha, lechupim ulishupim. V'shem achoto ma'acha. Shem achoto ma'acha. Whose sister is ma'acha? Machir or lechupim and shupim? This is confusing. Why would it be shame achoto instead of shame achotam?
Right. Yeah, so I think it's machir.
V'shem hasheni tzlofchad v'tiena litzlofchad banot. So in addition to machir, we have a second son. Right? We have this machir, father of Gilad. Machir took a wife, chupim mushupim, sister ma'acha. We'll come back to sister ma'acha. And the other son, tzlofchad, besides machir, who had daughters of fame, not Tzlofchad, so from Shevet Menashe. So how did Chupim and Shupim enter into this conversation? So Chupim and Shupim actually are mentioned in the Torah.
But under aliases or something?
No. Chupim and Shupim. Right? Their names are there. Their names are there. Again, I come back to those parts of Chumash. Not only Nach, but those parts of Chumash where we tend to really gloss over, our minds tend to wander even during Kriyas HaTorah, and which should never be the case, but in that anyway. And even when we learn the parsha, we get to these lists of names, and we kind of, even lists of names and numbers confuse us. But as we delve into them a little more deeply, source number 6, Bamidbar Perek Chaf Vav, Parshat. By coincidence, it happens to be Parshat Pinchas. That really is purely coincidental. Bnei Binyamin is listing the second census. They took a census in the beginning of Bamidbar before they left Har Sinai, and then 40 years later, yes, 40 years later, they are ready to go into the land of Israel. They take a census again, and they recount all the tribes. And remember that the tribe at census is always taken by family name. So here's a listing of the family lineage of Shevet Binyamin. Bnei Binyamin. Do you remember I once told you that Binyamin had... Did we ever talk about the fact that Binyamin had 10 sons? Binyamin had 10 children. It's an interesting story by itself. Don't bother turning to the page. I just want to take a quick glance at something before we go any further. I should have given you this pasuk. The 10 sons of Binyamin are mentioned as they go down to Mitzrayim. Binyamin, in that count of all the tribes of all the families of Yaakov that go down to Mitzrayim, there are 70 souls that go down to Mitzrayim, right? 69 plus Yaakov. So there, Bnei Binyamin are listed. There are 10 of them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. They are Bela, Becher, Ashbel, Gera, Naaman, Achi, Rosh, Mupim, and Chupim, and Ard. Okay. 10 sets. Now in Binyamin, in Parshat Pinchas, they're mentioned again in slightly different variations. Sometimes names over the course of time change, either dialect change, or names change, but the identification of these tribes somewhat shifts. And we have the following. Bnei Binyamin l'mishpachotam, l'vela, vela, bet lamen ayin, mishpachat ha-bal'i, the family of Bela is called the family of the Bal'i family, Ashbel, mishpachat ha-ashbeli, Ashbel family, the Ashbeli family, Achiram, mishpachat ha-achidami, lishfufam, Mishpachat Shufami, right? Shufam, similar to Shupim, and Lechufam, Mishpachat Chufami, similar to the name Chupim. That was very lateral thinking, but okay. And then the continuation of Ibn Bela, Arvan, Aman, Mishpachat Ardi, and the rest of the names are not our issue. So here we have a reference to Chupim and Shupim as two of the sub-tribes of Shevet Binyamin. We have this strange reference in Divrei Hayamim to Machir ben Menashe, so he's already a nephew to Binyamin. Lakach Isha l'chupim umil Shupim, for Chupim and Shupim, which makes no sense because Chupim and Shupim are children of Binyamin. So why would Machir be taking a wife for Chupim and Shupim when Chupim and Shupim are not his children, they are Binyamin's children?
Well, couldn't you, two brothers can name their children?
Possibly.
The same name.
It is possible, but then we would find them in the list of Menashe's children, but we don't. Right? Menashe's children are also listed, and they're not, Chupim and Shupim are not listed amongst the tribes or sub-tribes of Menashe. So in this context, says the Rabag, Machir lakach isha, Ratzono lamar, lakach isha mehem. He took a wife from them. Vehem bnei ir shezachar lamala. Okay. The name of the city mentioned earlier. ולמען דאמר לחופים ולשופים רצונו לומר, ומכיר לקח אישה שהייתה אחות לחופים ולשופים. Some interpret this to mean, and this is our jumping point, that he took a wife who was the sister of chupim and shupim. And that's why it says, Shem achoto ma'acha. Meaning, achoto is the sister of the more... It says achoto, not achotam, chazar ala nichbad mehem. Chupim shekdimo l'shupim. When you mention a list of children, so the most significant, the head of the family, the oldest, the Ephraim before the Menashe, he becomes the symbol of the family, and his sister could be the sisters of others also, but in this case, his sister would have been the one under discussion, and therefore, Chupim are in this regard the children of Binyamin, whose sister Ma'acha marries Machir ben Menashe. Cousins. They're first cousins,
aren't they?
They are Chupim Mishim ben Menashe, Machir ben Menashe. It's an uncle.
First cousin once removed.
I love this term.
Right? First cousin once removed. Certainly legitimate marriage, but the notion suddenly is, it's very telling, it's very revealing, that Machir, who is the father of Gilad, the mother of Gilad, is the sister of Chupim and Shupim, meaning that the mother of Gilad is Mshevet Binyamin. So even though we've seen many times that tribal lineage goes to the father, we've also seen that in certain instances there's a preservation of the ties from the tribal connection of the mother. We saw that by Shimshon, correct? Where he goes running to Bnei Yehuda because his mother is from Yehuda and they don't take too kind. But in this case, it suddenly sheds a great deal of light on why Binyamin doesn't come to this campaign. Sorry, why Yavesh Gilad doesn't come to this campaign. What was assumed to be a kind of, they took a big census and they saw that everybody was there except suddenly they found one little tiny city sitting out there in the middle of nowhere called Yavesh Gilad, and they said, oh, Yavesh Gilad, they're neutral. It's not quite as simple as that. They took a census to make sure that everybody was united in this campaign against Binyamin. And the conspicuous absence was Yavesh Gilad. I don't think it was an accident, and I don't think it was unnoticed, but because so much of they took a big census of every tribe, but because everybody understood the Gilad is not just a sub-tribe of Menashe, but Gilad is a sub-tribe of Menashe, first cousin, once removed, twice removed, 12 times removed, however many generations you are, from Binyamin. So there's a much closer relationship between the Gilad and Binyamin than between any other tribe.
Well, I'm sure there was intermarriage between them.
Correct, but remember that tribal lineage is defined in these Sifrayuchs. And when they settled the land of Israel, they settled it by tribal region. Right? The Gilad is called Gilad because it was settled by Gilad ben Menashe. I'll even go one step further. I don't know if you remember this discussion, but when we way back in the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua. How many years ago was that? At the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua, I mentioned the possibility that Gilad ben Machir ben Menashe had actually settled in the area of the Gilad contemporary to the story of Shibud Mitzrayim. Do you remember the Bnei Ephraim that had left early? So there's a possibility from certain Sukkim and Divayamim that the area, tribal areas of the east, of Ephraim, of Menashe, and of that region, and of Ephraim in certain areas in Israel, had actually, these were tribes from Yosef's children that had left early because they were free, and they had gone and settled in their ancestral land. So that Menashe, this area of the Gilad, is a very old settlement of the tribe of Menashe, but cousins to Binyamin. And suddenly, when they're not heart of this unified campaign, that unity is cracked along a very dangerous fault line. So they decide to address it. And they take out Yavesh Gilead. The entire unity of Israel against the innocent city of Yavesh Gilead. Because they're an easy target. It's not just an arbitrary target. They're Binyamin's first cousins. So, of course it's going to make a difference in the message to Binyamin. Remember who their primary target is. Their primary target is Binyamin. They're afraid of engaging Binyamin. Why engage the first-line Marines when they can engage, right, the reserves sleeping in their barracks at home? But it's all part of the same family. So when they said to Binyamin, oh, you either come to war, either give us the perpetrators or we're going to not marry you. Give us the perpetrators or we're going to take a unified front against you, and anybody who doesn't come to this front will be killed. The first people that they turn to is the very cousins of Binyamin who are neutral in this whole campaign.
Do we know Gilead is more than Yavesh Gilead? Do we know if any idea whether it was more than just one city's taken out rather than the whole of the area?
No, we don't. And remember, there's only 12,000 soldiers, but I suspect that Yavesh Gilead is one of the major settlements. They're not. It's not like today where you look at an area and you have a geographic defined line on a map. Boundaries in Tanakh, there is no significance to lines on a map. The area was defined by the cities that identify themselves in that regard. So, but that explains a great deal of why Yavesh Gilead was so significant to the campaign at this point. Now, just to reverse course for a moment.
I'm still a little confused there.
Why?
Because you said, why is Pinchas so zealous against Yavesh Gilead?
I haven't gotten to Pinchas yet.
Oh,
I first want to start with why Yavesh Gilead didn't come. What's the issue with Yavesh Gilead? This isn't the Pinchas issue, this is a Klal Yisrael issue?
Yeah, that makes correct. Perfect sense. They're not going to go and, like, you know, try and annihilate their own family.
Correct.
Why were they neutral?
No, why Binyamin is neutral. Why Yavesh Gilead? Why Yavesh Gilead is neutral makes perfect sense.
So why weren't they siding with Binyamin?
Probably because they were smart.
What do you mean? And the other people weren't smart?
No, Binyamin were had. Remember, Binyamin. Just why they didn't side with Binyamin? Binyamin's not blameless in this story. Binyamin's hands are not clean.
Right.
So for them to stand up and side with Binyamin when Binyamin are the perpetrators of this story of Pelegesh, let's not forget the poor Pelegesh and their accomplices and their protectors. Yavesh Gilad's got more sechel than that.
But Binyamin had skilled fighters, and they could have protected.
Yeah, there's still 400,000 Israelites there, and there's, you know, so Binyamin is the one under siege, so they don't have a choice but to protect themselves. Yavesh Gilad is a cousin of 18 generations back,
and a distance away,
uh-huh. And they have no skin in the game. They have no issue in this campaign, so the best they can do is stay out of it. The smartest thing they can do is stay out of it. Unfortunately, it didn't turn out so smart for them. But that's certainly, from their perspective, the smartest thing to do. Right? Leave us alone. I'm not going to go to war against Binyamin, my 20th cousin, but I'm not necessarily going to side with you either. And then that evokes the wrath of Bnei Yisrael as a whole, Pinchas in particular, but I haven't come to the role of Pinchas quite yet.
But does he have something specific against them?
He has something very specific. Yes, he has a very specific, not so much against Yavesh Gilead, but about its location, and we're going to come to that in a moment. But I just wanted to show you one other piece. We may actually do that Pinchas piece next week. We'll see. But there's a flip side. The flip side is, and this was something that Ruthie mentioned before, the flip side is you see the implication of this many, many years later. The connection between Binyamin and Yavesh Gilead is a recurring theme, and that's why it becomes an issue that will hover over Tanakh for so many years. Who is the most famous Binyaminite in descendant of Binyamin in Jewish history?
Mordechai.
Sure. I thought it was going to go to Mordechai. I don't think so. Sure. I think that's true only because of, in hindsight, of the story of Purim, sure. But certainly in Tanakh, Mordechai's role is far less significant than another famous player from Binyamin, Shaul HaMelech. Shaul HaMelech, right? First king of Israel. Bayimim mehem ein melech b'Yisrael. First king of Israel, Shaul HaMelech. Shaul HaMelech's first campaign. Shaul HaMelech's, not only is his first campaign, but the campaign that ultimately leads to his approval, or the people's approval of Shaul as their choice of king, is in Sefer Shmuel Aleph, Perek Yud Aleph. Yeah, this one you can go to. Might as well start from the beginning of the parak, otherwise you won't see the context.
36.
Okay, we'll leave Pinchas for another week.
It's Shmuel Aleph Perek Yud Aleph, right? Yes.
Shmuel Aleph Perek Yud Aleph.
It's 336.
Vayal Nachash Ha'amoni Vayichan al Yavesh Gilad. Nachash Ha'amoni, Ammon. Remember that Ammon and Moab are the cities, the nations. We learned this back in Shoftim when we did Yiftach. And Ammon and Moab, many, many, many moons ago, had once lived in this area here, but Sichon, king of Amori, had expelled them. Then Israel came and conquered the land from Sichon, so they now live here, Rabat Ammon, capital of Ammon, Moab a little bit further south. This is the joined area of Ammon and Moab together. Yavesh Gilad is all the way, but Ammon goes all the way up north. So to the east of the area of the Gilad sits the kingdom of Ammon. Nachash is the name of the king of Ammon. Nachash Ammoni comes and wages war against Yavesh Gilad. Yavesh Gilad evidently had a tendency to try to remain out of campaigns. Didn't serve them well back then, but maybe it'll serve them better here. Kol anshei Yavesh el Nachash, Yavesh, the city of Yavesh, capital major city of the area of the Gilad, said to Nachash, king of Ammon, Krot lanu brit v'navdeka, you're a border city, you're vulnerable, Your army is sitting on our borders. Tell us your terms, and we'll serve you. You know, if that's what it will take. So we don't want to get involved in a war. Vayomer alehem Nachash ha'amoni. Bezot echrot lachem. I'll tell you. Here are my terms. Min kor lachem kol ayin yamin v'samti acherpa al kol Yisrael. Every member of Yavesh Gilad, you'll forgive me, gouge out their right eye and send it to me. Right? Now, we just finished Parshat Mishpatim. Right? We just finished Parshat Mishpatim. Amongst the many halachot in Parshat Mishpatim is the halacha that if you hit an eved and take out their shen or ayin, take out their eye or their tooth, you set them free. Right? If you maim your eved, you set them free. Because, and here's a very good example of it, what was prevalent in the world of Tanakh was that a conquering army that enslaved a population did so by branding them. You branded your slave. You took out a tooth, you took out an eye, you took out a... And that's how you branded your slaves. So, not out of the ordinary, if Yavesh, to say, we saw at the very beginning of Sefer Shoftim, one of the kings was boasting about how many thumbs he had sitting under his table in a box, right? This is what they did. Remember that? Beginning of Sefer... Ehud, king of... Eglon Melech Moav. Very beginning of Sefer... So this was the Kushan Mishatayim, I think it was. This was the mentality. This was the you branded your slave. So the Torah went to war against it by telling Bnei Israel, if you had slaves and you branded them or you maimed them in any way, it was an automatic get out of jail free card. And that was the way the Torah reversed were struggled, challenged this culture. In the meantime, that was the terms that Nachash had set for Yavesh Gilad. The response, Pasuk Gimel, Vayamru Elav Ziknei Yavesh, Ziknei Yavesh said to Nachash, Heref Lanu Shivat Yamim, give us 7 days to consider. V'nishlacha malachim v'chogvu Yisrael, will send messengers amongst the tribes of Israel. Im en moshi otanu v'yatzanu elecha. If nobody comes to our aid, then we'll come out to you. So either we'll come out to you in war, or we'll come out to you in acceptance of your terms, is unclear. But I don't really think that they actually said that to Nachash, king Aharon, because it would be a stupid thing to say to Nachash. Give us 7 days so we can see if anybody's going to save us, and if not, then we'll negotiate.
Right?
That's not what they said. What they said was, give us 7 days. End of sentence. In the meantime, what's going on in their mentality, in their mindset, is, let's send to Bnei Israel and see who'll come to save us. That's the negotiation. So the malachim come, these messengers of Yavesh Gilad come to near Yerushalayim, to an area of Givat Sha'ul. Givat Sha'ul is named Givat Sha'ul later, but it's because that's where Sha'ul lived, but it's referred to here in hindsight as the fact that it's Givat Sha'ul. They spoke to the people, and what was the people's reaction? So here's the negotiation, here's the conversation. Think about it for a moment. Here's the conversation. Messengers from Yavesh Gilad come to the area of Yerushalayim, not of Yerushalayim, but of Givat Sha'ul, and they tell them, we are being attacked by Nachash. He wants to threaten us, and if we surrender, he's going to insist that his tribute will be very high taxes. Right? Response to the people. Vayisuot kolam vayivku. They cried. And why did they cry? Who are they crying for?
They felt sorry for their brothers.
They felt sorry for them.
They weren't going to go help them.
Yeah. Right? Oh, Nebuch, you poor people of Yavesh Gilad, you're all going to lose your right eye. I'm so sorry. It breaks my heart to hear that you're all going to lose your right eye. Right? Our heart bleeds for you, right? So they're all sitting and crying over Nebuch, the forlorn waste, gone, destroyed, terrible calamity that's going to befall the people of Yavesh Gilad. Shaul, who at this point is depicted as this kind of little shepherd, who happens to be walking in from the field. What are they crying about? So he comes over and he's like, why are you crying? So this poor guy turns to Shaul and he says, we're crying because Yavesh just told us that they're being attacked by Nachash and he wants them to gouge out the right eye, and Nebuch, these people of Yavesh, are going to all lose the right eye. When Shaul heard this, he got angry. Why did he get angry?
Their reaction.
Partially to their inaction, and partially because poor Yavesh Gilad, somebody's got a.
They had already been divided.
Well, that we don't. That part of the story isn't yet clear to us that that's going through his mind, but it will be in a moment. Vayichar apomod gets very angry. So now, what is he going to do? He is going to lead a campaign to defend Yavesh Gilad against the army of Nachash, but you can't do that by yourself. Remember, he's not yet king. The end of this story, the people anoint him as their king. What does he do? He needs to gather an army together, right?
Oh, the barbecue?
Now, the last time an army got together...
They sent the pieces of...
Last time an army got together, they were quite strong, right? When you get all the tribes of Israel together, you can amass a significant army, correct? But how do you amass them all together? How do you mobilize them all? Vayikach, semed bakar. So he took a pair of ox. Vayinatcheu. And he cut them up. into 12 pieces, I suspect.
Yeah.
Here we go again. And he sent them with the very messengers. He sent them to all the boundaries of Israel. He sent them north, south, to all the land, all the tribes of Israel. And I suspect he uses the same messengers that came from Yavesh Gilad for a reason. And he said to them, to every tribe of Israel who got a piece of this bakar, you can only imagine what the poor postal man is thinking. Oh, God, in you. Here we go again, right? It's another box with a piece in it. Asher enenu yotze acharei Shaul v'acharei Shmuel ko ya'ase livkaro. Anybody who doesn't come out to fight this campaign with me, this that's what I do to their oxen.
Yeah, but he also takes on Shmuel's...
Brings along Shmuel. He's not going into war without the Navi. He is not going into war without the Navi. That is correct. That is part of his leadership strength. And he gathers them all together. Vayipol pachad Hashem al ha'am. The fear of God fell over the people. I think it was the fear of God plus the fear of Shaul, right? Or the fear of Shaul. Vayetzu. Now listen to the form, to the formulation. Listen to the phraseology. Vayetzu ke'ish echad. Sound familiar? Vayifkadem bebazek. They took a census. They took an account of the army. How many did they gather? Vayu b'nei so shlosh me'at elavish. 300,000 from the rest of Israel. Ve'ish Yudah shloshim alef. And another 30,000 from Yudah. 330,000. Last time we were able to gather an army of that magnitude was ki'ish echad, was Pilegesh Begivah. Also motivated by a parcel post.
Right?
And what's interesting is that they don't talk about why he did this. Why did he cut up the animal? There's no other precedent for it. Nowhere else in Tanakh is that kind of methodology used to mobilize an army. This is not a typical mobilization call. Usually your typical mobilization call is you blow a shofar. And those who come, come. And this is very atypical. But I don't think it's an accident. I think it was in his mind. Here's Yavesh Gilad, hundreds of years later, being attacked, and Bnei Yisrael, again, are sitting now and turn the tide. Instead of Binyamin being attacked and Yavesh Gilad sitting this one out, or all of Israel going attacking Yavesh Gilad, here's the tables are turned. Here's Yavesh Gilad being attacked, and all of Israel sitting there going... Nabuch. Nabuch.
So was this a tikkun for Yavesh?
I think it was. I think it was. And I think ultimately it's a rectification.
Right? Why did he have so much strength that he could mobilize everything? Just
well,
right? Why did he...
So when we get
to, why was he the strongest
right.
individual?
So when we get to Sefer Shmuel, that's...
King yet.
Right. Well, he is anointed. He is appointed to be designated
okay,
to be king. So we'll talk about that when we get to Sefer Shmuel. I can't address that question now because we need to look at the first 10 prakim of Sefer Shmuel to be able to get there. But I will come back to that. No, that's a good question, but I will come back to that. In the meantime, Vayomnu l'malachim abaim. She said to the malachim, Kot omnu l'ish Yavesh Gilad. This is what you say to Ish Yavesh Gilad, to the army of Yavesh Gilad, to the people, to the entity of Yavesh Gilad. Machar tiye lechem tshua k'chom ha-shemesh. Tomorrow by noon, you will be saved. This isn't going to go on. V'yavoh ha-malachim v'yagidu l'anshei Yavesh Gilad, Yavesh v'yismachu. They rejoiced. V'yamlu anshei Yavesh, machar netze alechem v'asitem lanu k'chol ha-tov b'nechem. The rest of the story is the story of actually the campaign and the battle and the victory over Ammon, which takes one day. Nachash goes running, sees the army and basically goes running, and then they turn to Shaul and says, after such a campaign, you be our king. But it's fascinating that Shaul's first campaign, which ultimately leads to the establishment of the first king of Israel, is in defense of Yavesh Gilad. Shaul from Shevet?
Binyamin.
So the Machut Yisrael, and that's the amazing connection to the story of Pilegesh Begivah, Machut Yisrael starts from the moment that Shaul comes to lead a united army of Israel, Ki'ish Echad, in defense of Yavesh Gilad, and not to attack Yavesh Gilad. It's the exact opposite of what took place in the story of Peleg Ishbegiva. That's the power of it. Which I think comes back to the Pinchas point. And if I have 12 minutes left, maybe I can do the Pinchas point in 12 minutes. Maybe. And that will save us an entire shiur. But if I come back to the question I asked originally, which is what's driving the wrath of Pinchas? The wrath of Pinchas is driven in part by the location of Yavesh Gilad.
Like across the Arden?
Right. The fact that, and I don't even think he's thinking Binyamin, first cousin, once removed, not once removed, 12 generations. I don't think that's going through his mind. What's going through his mind is that the unity of Israel, the crack, the fault line that he's so concerned about, is the fault line of the Jordan River. Now that fault line is a dangerous one. We have seen it already many times. We saw it most recently, although not chronologically, but by chapter. We saw it by Yiftach. Remember the Yiftach's war with Ephraim?
Yes.
Shibolet, Sibolet, 42,000. Interesting number there too. Right. Slaughtered them. And Yiftach comes from Yiftach, huh? Giladi, right? Yiftach came from the Gilad. Yiftach came from the Gilad. Before Yiftach, we had there were three civil wars in Sefer Shoftim. Yiftach, this is the third, Lagish Begiva, Yavesh Gilad, really. The second was Yiftach, the first was Gidon. And Gidon's war was against the cities of, anybody remember? Gidon's civil war was against the cities of Pnuel and remember what happened when Gideon was chasing the enemy Midian, and he comes to these two cities on the way. He's tired and he's hungry and he wants them to give him quarter and they refuse. Hakaf Zevach v'tzamuna biyadecha, do you have the enemy? And we're going to stay neutral. Evidently it was the characteristic of the tribes on the east of the Yarden to try to stay neutral, which I understand given the fact that there's so much more. Yeah.
That's not what they promised.
Exposed.
Moshe. That's not what they promised Moshe.
That is true. That's not what they promised Moshe. But the ones who promised Moshe, if you remember, were whom?
Reuben and God.
Reuben and God.
Right.
Manasseh was never part of that conversation.
True.
Well,
he's on both sides anyway.
Okay. First of all, Manasseh's on both sides, and second of all, as I alluded to earlier, Manasseh was always on the east side of the Yarden, because that was their ancestral land from the days of Machir and Gilad when they settled there. So the ones who requested to stay in the east, they were Reuben and God, and they fulfilled their mission and mandate to Yoshua. But this is already years later. Pnuel and Sukkot are the two cities that Gidon from Ephraim, Gidon ben Yoash from Ephraim, he attacks, and they are two cities along the Yabok River, Pnuel and Sukkot, also in the land of the southern part of the Gilad. And evidently this tribal warfare, if you will, across the Jordan River was quite dangerous. The first time we find reference to this threat over the potential division of the land of Israel over the Jordan River was by Pinchas in Sefer Yehoshua. Remember the story? Let's take a look at it, because that's, we have few minutes left. Let's take a look at it. This is really critical. This is the answer to the question I started with, which is why Pinchas led this campaign, the slaughter of Yavesh Gilad. Take a look in Yehoshua Perek Chaf Bet, chapter 22. Somebody will find the page.
285. I don't know. Possibly.
We'll come to that in a second. Let me find it. Starting with Pasuk Tet. This is the end of Sefer Yehoshua. Yehoshua has dismissed the 2.5 tribes, Reuben and Gad, from their and half Manasseh from their duties of, at the end of the conquest of the land of Israel. They've done their share, as they had promised Moshe. They fulfilled that bargain. Yehoshua sends them home to their land east of the Yarden. They leave Shiloh, because that's where the Yehoshua had gathered the people, and lalechet el eretz ha-Gilad, to go home to their land in the Gilad, el eretz ha-Chuzatam ha-Shenah ha-Chazuba, al-Pi Hashem b'yad Moshe. ויבואו אל גלילות הירדן אשר בארץ כנען, ויבנו בני ראובן ובני גד וחצי שבט המנשה שם מזבח על הירדן, מזבח גדול למראה. 2.5 tribes, they come to the Yarden, they cross the Yarden, and they build, I won't get into the conversation in the Machloket and the Mefarshim, whether on the east bank or the west bank of the Yarden, but they build a giant mizbeach. A big mizbeach, big enough to be seen.
And they got in trouble.
Correct. וישמו בני ישראל למור, הנה בנו בני ראובן ובני גד וחצי שבט המנשה את המזבח מול ארץ כנען על גלילות הירדן על עבר בני ישראל. בני ישראל heard that Reuben and God had built this giant מזבח. וישמו בני ישראל, they heard this, they got angry. ויקלו כל עדת בני ישראל שילה לעלות עליהם לצבא. They gathered together to go to war against the very brothers who just fought with them for 7.5 years, they go, 14 years, they go to war. Where do they gather to lead this war? Shiloh. Why in Shiloh? Because that's where the Mishkan is. What did they build that was so offensive to them? Mizbeach. Looks like they built themselves their own Mishkan. So how dare they? You build one Mishkan. Remember, we've talked about this so many times. The foundation of monotheism in the Torah is there's one place, one Mishkan, one Mikdash. Makom HaSheYivchar Hashem. Back to Pesach Micha. Mm-hmm. Right? One location. How dare they build themselves their own Mizbeach? And on top of it, on the east side of the Yarden, as if to say that the east side of the Yarden is a separate country, is a separate land than the west side of the Yarden.
Or as good as, but deserving
of its own Mishkan. If its own Mishkan means it's a separate country. So Vayishlachu b'nei Yisrael u'b'nei Reuven u'b'nei Gad v'chatzi shevet Menashe al eretz ha-Gilad et Pinchas ben Elazar ha-Kohen. Who led this army? Pinchas. Because he comes whenever, and that's the question, what links all the places where Pinchas appears? What links all the places where Pinchas appears?
War.
Right? War. Not every war. Problems. There are a lot of wars where Pinchas stays out of it. Think about it for a second. The places where Pinchas appears in our Sefer Shoftim, the first place is the Mizbeach built by Reuven and God, and then we don't hear from him for a long time till Yavesh Gilad.
So what's he doing all that time?
What's the common denominator between the Mizbeach on the east of the Yarden and Yavesh Gilad?
Separating yourself out, lack of unity.
The role that the east side of Israel would play to the east side of the Yarden would play in relationship to the west side. Pinchas' zealotry was to defend what? Was to defend the integrity? Not just the unity of Bnei Israel. Unity, they fought many civil wars in Israel, many times. But specifically the territorial integrity. He comes to defend Shiloh. He's the Kohen Gadol. He comes to defend, by the sword if necessary, the central role of Shiloh as the one and only place of Avodat Hashem. Correctly so. Shiloh belongs, should be, the one and only place of Avodat Hashem. We learned that's the foundational issue of Avodah Zarah in the land of Israel, Sefer Shoftim. We learned that that's the issue with Pesach Micha. Although
why did Pinchas
go to war against Pesach Micha, we don't know, but that comes back to the question the Gemara asked, right? God the Malachim come to the God and say, why don't you take out Shiloh? And he's Pesach Micha, and God says, you know what, they're very nice to us, to others in Shiloh.
They made a mistake by not building a hotel there.
Right? But can you imagine? Go back to everything we said about Pesach Micha. And the whole culture of the Mishkan as a place of corruption we see in Hophni and Pinchas, the sons of Eli, many years later. When you've got Pinchas Kohen Gadol, who's operating the Mishkan as a kind of zealots, a house of zealotry, where anybody who challenges the authority of Shiloh and the centrality of Shiloh is going to meet the wrath of Pinchas, and the path of and the wrath of Pinchas is the point of a sword or a spear. And that particular story happened to end well because they explained to Pinchas that they were really not trying to separate themselves. They were just trying to build a monument so that tomorrow your children shouldn't say to our children, you were separated from the land of Israel. But the reality is that that's precisely what happened. That this Jordan River became a hotbed of contention over the east and west, the allegiance of the tribes east of the Yarden. And Yavesh Gilad is a symbol of that allegiance. They're constantly staying out of the issues. They're constantly being neutral. They're neutral with Yavesh Gilad, with Nachash HaAmoni. And they're neutral in our case. And Pinchas stands up and says, you can't be neutral. Are you part of Bnei Yisrael? You're not part of Bnei Yisrael. This is an old issue for Pinchas. He fought it with Reuven and Gad. Now he's going to fight it with Menashe. This is an old issue. Are you part of Bnei Yisrael? You're not part of Bnei Yisrael. And the irony of Jewish history is, or biblical history is, that there are numerous civil wars in Tanakh. More than we like to admit. Especially when you dealt with the kingdom of the north, the northern kingdom of Israel, where kingdoms, dynasties, didn't last very long. 3-4 generations at most. But they didn't end because they resigned their position or abdicated their throne, right?
It was a coup d'etat.
They ended when the king was killed. So I once showed you this chart. It's on the other side of the source page, and I pulled it out from my study of Sefer Yehoshua. It's a remarkable chart. It's a record of the four major coup d'etats. Well, I don't know what the plural of coup d'etats is. Coups d'etat or... But the four major moments in Jewish history when the kings of Israel were executed or killed in a coup, and in all four cases, the boundary line cuts across the Jordan River. It's either people on the west killing the king who was appointed from the east, or the people on the east killing the king who was appointed from the west. And what's fascinating is that the tension back and forth is between Shechem, the capital of Har Ephraim, and Yavesh Gilad, or the Gilad of the east. And if you look at the names even, it's really remarkable. Yehud ben Nimshi was from the Gilad. Eliyahu and Elisha from the Gilad. Beit Omri. Omri is the king who builds Shechem. His nemesis, Achav, his nemesis is Elisha, as Eliyahu Navi. Eliyahu comes from the nemesis in a good sense, the Navi, right? Against Achav. He comes from the Gilad. And Yehud ben Nimshi from the Gilad is the one who is the king who's told to go and kill the last descendant of the house of Omri. You know, there's Shechem, king from the descendants of the east, being killed by Yehud ben Nimshi from the Gilad. The house of Yehud, five generations, eventually taken out by Shalom ben Yavesh. Now, we don't necessarily know where Shalom ben Yavesh is, but Shalom ben Yavesh, considering the fact that Yavesh is not only that Gilad is called Gilad because of the name of the descendant of Menashe, whose name is Gilad, it stands to reason Yavesh could also be an identification of place. Shalom ben Yavesh himself is killed by Menachem ben Gadi. Tirtza is also in the I'm not sure what Tirtza is. I think it's in the east. Tirtza is in the Emek Yisrael. You had it once before. Tirtza is Emek Yisrael. Shalom ben Yavesh from Yavesh Gilad, ostensibly killed by king from Emek Yisrael in the west. Pekach ben Menachem killed by Pekach ben Remaliah veHagil Adim are the ones who ultimately kill Bet Menachem ben Gadi. So back and forth, the location, the names of the places that play a role. This is for this is Sefer Melachim in a nutshell. This is 400 years of Sefer Melachim, back and forth over the boundary of the land of Israel, and specifically the tug of war, the tension between Yavesh or the Gilad, and the rest of the land.
No, we don't have that with Yehuda because it's all Yehuda west of.
Number one, the kings of Yehuda were not executed in a coup d'état because they're all from Shevet, they're all from David.